Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guest house overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission.
I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer reporting from the Waiheke coastal dunes and wetlands on the island of Maui. Come along and join me for a visit with Scott Fisher, Director of Land Stewardship, and Olu Campbell, CEO of Hawaiian Land Trust. Campbell explains, Hawaii Land Trust protects the lands that sustain Hawaii and teaches future generations to do the same. Who legally owns the land here today?
The Hawaii Land Trust. It was going to be a destination golf course. A Japanese company purchased it in 1988. In my office, we still have the plans of which holes were going to be where, and for reasons that didn't involve us, that project did not get off the ground. Largely, it was due to the fact that the cultural resources here were more abundant than anybody anticipated, especially they anticipated. So when they started doing their archaeological inventory survey, extensive archaeological features, and that took time. Again, it didn't have anything to do with us or any of our work. We didn't stop it, but now we are the beneficiary of both that knowledge through the archaeological research, but also that we can perpetuate.
Did you do an outreach campaign to generate the dollar donations to buy the land?
Yes. Fortunately, there are programs through the state and the federal government. So a little bit of that. We are now actually, some of our fundraising is, we have a larger staff and we have a much more experienced staff that can actually facilitate that. When we were purchasing Waiheke, we are a staff of two. What we did is we relied on federal, state, and county funds, and ultimately that put together $4.8 million to purchase the 277 acres, which we got a great deal. And so the Destination Golf Company, they really did work with us. They saw the value in what we do.
That's pretty cool. Part of that might have been economic graphic changes with the Japanese.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. In the 1980s and early 1990s, Japanese investment in the Hawaiian Islands was extensive. Huge. Yeah, it was huge. That changed slowly. Of course, the Japanese economy went through some struggles in the mid to late 90s. And so, again, we're the beneficiary of that. The company that originally purchased it went bankrupt. And so we just happened to be there. And it's very fortuitous for us. And so I'm always amazed at the number of landowners who are willing to work with us, mainly because they just want to see land protected.
The other dynamic is, as a landowner, you're always concerned about surviving yourself.
Yes,
economically.
Exactly.
Looking in from the outside, that economic incentive, tax change,
yes,
making it more affordable to retain their land. Talk to us about that dynamic.
You know, the financial sustainability of being a landowner is a big hurdle, right? And so a lot of people come to us with these types of acquisitions, not maybe realizing that it's not just the acquisition that needs to take place, it's the perpetual stewardship that we need to prepare ourselves for. Because if we are not prepared to be good stewards in the long term, then whatever the acquisition might be can very quickly become more of a liability than it will be an asset that's community serving, right? So now when we do any acquisitions, we're fundraising both for the acquisition cost, we're also fundraising for perpetual stewardship endowment funds that we can invest and that provides a draw for us, that have a baseline, right, of management. So like Scott said, we'll still pull funding from these public sources for acquisitions, and then we'll work very collaboratively with various partners and community members who are well-resourced, who can donate, who have the capacity to be philanthropists, and they can contribute to these other types of pools of money that we need to set us up for success. Things like you mentioned, like tax benefits, all those things, they all come into play. A lot of times, because we're a 501c3, those tax benefits aren't received by us, but those who we work with receive tax benefits for their donations,
right,
to forward our mission. Yeah,
which is a definite incentive to step
for
up,
sure,
to the plate.
Yeah, and so sometimes those tax benefits will be through cash donations. Other times, it'll be through other in-kind donations. So, for example, we have a project that's going to be starting starting here at Waiheke soon for the reconstruction of an old structure that we're going to turn into a cultural learning center to supplement and improve our education programs here. And so through a project like that, we'll work with community companies that can provide discounted labor, for example, or discounted materials, and they can get tax benefits that way. In other cases, like Scott mentioned earlier, the private landowner might retain the fee title and ownership of their land, but their donation of that conservation easement will be tax deductible to a certain extent. There's a bunch of federal regulations on how that can be done, so that to make sure that people aren't taking advantage of it. But yeah.
Intrinsic in your model would be supporters, membership. Yes. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, supporters, Hawaii Land Trust is very thankful because we have a great network of supporters, both individual supporters who are kama'aina, and also a network of supporters who may be here on Maui, for example, for just part of the year, and actually national amount of support for people who are not even come here, but they support the cause and they believe in the mission.
Outreach, how do you make yourself known to people?
It's very personal. We try to be present with people and provide people the opportunity to understand the work that we're doing, the benefit that this work has on our community and our place. Honestly, a lot of our work sells itself. We don't have to do that much marketing of the work that we do because it's so good. The work that Scott does and our team does on the site, our education team, the number of students that we serve every year and the impact that that creates, it really sells itself. So our focus, we do a lot of fundraising, but that's not where our major focus is. Our major focus is doing the best job we can on the land and for our people. And that work speaks for itself when we go in to talk to people who are potential donors and foundations and other companies.
School, your little ambassador.
They have in some cases, yeah. You know, just recently we were talking to a local organization interested in contributing some funding. They were shocked by the fact that we have currently here at Waiheke a 500 student waiting list to access our education programs. And it's not that we're not serving a lot of students, we're serving a tremendous amount of students, thousands of students. Multiple school groups come out here every week and are using this place as an extension of their classrooms, but our staff just doesn't have the capacity to serve as many students, as many teachers that want that type of educational experience. In that sense, the community knows about that aina-based or land-based and culture-based education is more beneficial to learner outcomes, and because of that, the amount of support that we get for those types of programs is, yeah, people are looking for that.
One of the most successful programs that we've run is in collaboration with the University of Hawaii Maui College. We call it the Ahupua'a Stewards because it's designed for high school students who are considering going into the field of broadly defined malama aina, those who want to care for the land. You don't have to have an intention of a major in mind, but we want them to kind of explore what the life of being someone who serves the land would be like. And so it's a 6-week program. Most of the students are either juniors or seniors, and we have a few who recent graduates. And they'll come down to Waiheke. We'll go out to our other properties on Nu'u. But we're also, collaboratively, we work with other agencies to see, like, we want to expose them, you know, what their future might hold. And fortunately, this is the third year running it, and we can track the students. It's small enough that we can actually track them. Almost all of them are going into conservation-related fields, and so it's so gratifying to see that happening.
Seeds planted here.
Exactly. And, you know, all we're doing is facilitating that process. We're saying, here's what it could be like, here's how much we've enjoyed it, and this is maybe why you ought to consider it. Like I say, it's one of the most gratifying programs we run.
You have other land holdings. One I was reading about was your Navigator School.
Oh, yes.
Talk to us about that. That's so cool.
Yeah, so Mahukona on the north side of Hawaii Island, Kohala Coast, is our biggest acquisition that we're working on currently, and we're looking to close that transaction towards the end of this year. It's a $20 million project, of which we have about $1 million or so dollars left to raise to make that acquisition. It has a variety of very important, both natural and cultural components. Like you mentioned, there's a navigational cultural site there. I'm definitely not the expert of that site.
But they know for a fact that took place there.
Yeah, yes. So for generations, about 1,000 years, that place has been known as a site where people have come to learn traditional navigational practices. And those practices continue today at that place with our community partners there, Nakalai Va'a. They've built a voyaging canoe. They run educational programs dedicated to navigation. They practice at that cultural site, and they continue that cultural practice, can continue for future generations, right? And at the same time, there's native ecosystems there. It's a shoreline parcel, so there's the near shore environment that, you know, that we're conscious of and need to be good stewards of. There's a piece of the Kohala field system there, which is a traditional native Hawaiian dry land field system that extended for miles and miles, and there's a portion of that on that parcel. So 642 acres, lots that can happen there. We want to make sure that we're working collaboratively with our community partners there to have effective programming that's, you know, beneficial for their community.
Would it be primarily school groups coming out there, or would it be public access?
It's going to be a combination. Anytime we have a significant cultural site, we always need to be cognizant of how access to the site is being managed. And in many of the sites throughout Hawaii and other places, social media has just kind of had a very detrimental impact on these sites. And so whenever we're working towards stewardship of a site, we are very cognizant of how people are accessing it, making sure that access is managed and it's done in an appropriate way. And so I'm from Oahu. That's not my site. So we work very closely with those who have the responsibility, who have genealogical connections to that place, to make sure that we're following the practice of their ancestors and their families to determine how to best steward, right?
How do you staunch the negativity of social media Instagrammers and whatnot? That's a tough one.
It's a tough one. I couldn't say that I have a solution, but one strategy that we use is just kind of community awareness. Mm-hmm. You know, the more people who are good stewards of sites in general, and they approach cultural sites and other valuable community resources with a shared value set and a recognition that there's something special there that needs to be protected, the easier it becomes for us to manage things like social media, right?
They're your ambassadors.
They are.
And as Olu pointed out, community partnerships are so important to us. So, for example, at the Waiheke Refuge, there's a heiau, a temple site. And we recently formed a partnership with a halau known as Hanona Kulike o Pi'ilani. And they are in the process of actually rebuilding that heiau. So Ke ala ka'i honua heiau will be rebuilt with that partnership. And so there's no possible way that with the size of the staff that we have that we could do all the things that need to be done. And so leveraging that relationship. And that's really what it comes down to is how can those partnerships co-manage aspects. What can we do? What is our area of expertise? Anybody on staff who has expertise in rebuilding a heiau. And so that's where we turn to those partnerships. And so partnerships, absolutely critical.
Give us the big overarching story of what the organization is about and your different properties.
So the Hawaii Land Trust is a Hawaii-based 501c3 organization, nationally accredited land trust. As Scott may have mentioned, our mission is to identify these sites that contribute to a healthy, reciprocal relationship between our people and our place, so that when we work, we're benefiting our aina, our ecosystems are healthy, and at the same time, our community is healthy. And so that's our goal. And all the sites that we steward are related to improving that reciprocal relationship. So starting on one side of the archipelago on Kauai Island, we have a few sites there. We have 7 sites that we self-steward across the islands. 50 conservation easements that are owned by private landowners, but we steward the easement. Each of those easements are different and are preserving different values of those lands. So on Kauai, the sites that we self-steward, there's 2 of them. There's Wainiha, which is a small parcel right along the shoreline that provides access to a beach that's popular for people to visit for fishing and other recreation. And then we have Kahili, which is a very highly used beach and shoreline area that's both habitat, there's cultural resources there, and a very popular surf spot, so it's very heavily used. And so those are our 2 Kauai sites. We run education programs primarily at Kahili and volunteering, where we have students coming out to do outreach, science, planting of native species, and so forth.
You have docent interpreters?
So we have 2 staff on Kauai Island that serve as our conduits between the organization and the community. So they facilitate volunteer days, they facilitate educational programs, and they work collaboratively with neighboring landowners, community partners to make all that happen. On Oahu, we have a very similar thing happening out in Haula on the north shore, which is at Mauna Wila Heiau. That's a site that was acquired using, in part, public money, county funding, and it is a heiau site, which is a place of worship. That was a healing site, is what the stories tell us. And so we have a memorandum of understanding with elementary school that's basically a block away, where they use that site as an extension of their classroom. Oh, wow. And their students from Haula Elementary, they'll walk over, they'll do educational programs at Mauna Wila Heiau site, and they'll walk back to school. And so we have that ongoing relationship with that school, and we also will work with other neighboring schools in that area from the college level all the way down for various other things, archaeological work.
Kids have a sense of ownership there.
Yeah, exactly. That space has become a community space as well. Just last year, some of our programs. It was an educational program, actually, where in collaboration with students, they constructed the first traditional Hawaiian hale or house structure in over 100 years. So that space has become a place of gathering where, you know, we can bring elders from that community and they can teach our students. So a bunch of things happening there, most of it focused around education and land stewardship.
On Maui, and I'm kind of skipping over the islands of Lana'i and Molokai. Lana'i, we don't have any properties. Molokai, we have 3 easements there. But we don't have staff. We don't generally work. We work in partnership with the landowners there. But on Maui, we have 3 refuges. Of course, we're on the Waihe'i Refuge, so you're hearing quite a bit about that. Our other larger refuge is 81 acres, and that's what we call our Nu'u Refuge. When we purchased that property, we purchased it in 2011. We started managing it in about 2008. But the goal there was almost all of the properties that we own and manage, they have potential for recreational use or educational use. They are ecologically significant, ecologically important, and they have rich cultural sites. And so those are kind of the 3 things when we eye land for acquisition. Those are kind of the 3 things that we keep in mind. So Nu'u, as I mentioned, is 81 acres. And that 81 acres, about 5 acres of it is a very, very important wetlands, what's known as a palustrine discharge wetlands, meaning it's a spring-fed wetlands. At one point, it was actually converted into a fish pond. By 1882, it was already abandoned for a variety of reasons. But this pond is now home to 2 endangered species, the alai ke'okeo, or Hawaiian coot, and the i'o, or the Hawaiian stilt. What makes it particularly important, though, is that it's close enough to the Big Island where those birds that fly from other parts of Maui can land there, re-energize, rest and re-energize, and then can make it over to the Big Island. And so the critical element there is that those birds, if that pond were lost for any reason, if it were lost to development, if it were lost to other transitional uses, that connection between Maui and the Big Island would be lost, between Hawaii Island. And if that happens, then that species is more imperiled. So that's why we really eyed that. But it has incredible recreational potential. In fact, people are camping there all the time. In addition to that, we take about between 20 and 30 hikes annually there. About once every few weeks, we take a hike. In fact, tomorrow, I'm out there leading a hike there.
And how do you advertise the hikes?
What we do, we put it on our website. Yeah, we just say these are our public hikes. Truth be told, though, if anybody calls me up and says I want to go on a hike, yeah, I know you have a national audience, but if they call me up and say, hey, I really want to go out there, I'll find a hike that's already happening, or I'll try and schedule a hike. And they become quite popular, and I have to be careful about, you know, I do have stewardship activities I need to do out there.
Website, what works best for you on your social media?
Right now, we primarily focus on Instagram and Facebook. That's where most of our audience is, primarily on Instagram.
We have a blog, too. So, for example, I'm writing a history of Waihe'i, that is, in blog installments, which is actually reminiscent of how Hawaiian historians, they wrote these installments in the newspapers. Every time I'm writing them, I'm like, wow, I wonder if this is how Samuel Kamakau or David Malo felt. I did sort of the geological history. We're up to about the 1600s, so stay tuned. Go on our website and stay tuned, because we're going to be filling it in over the next 400 years. So.
Kind of fun being stuck in the past.
So. Yeah, exactly. We're using brand new technologies to actually share our love for this land, the mo'olelo, share the stories. I mean, that's what animates the work we do, is that we are literally standing in the footsteps of our kupuna. On Hawaii Island, we have 2 refuges. One, it's called Kuku'au, which was a very generous donation. And we are primarily focusing on wet forest management. Very talented staff member out there who's looking at, you know, the rainforest, kind of the mid-elevations. Well, it'd be on the slopes of Mauna Kea, and education. And then, of course, Mahukona. You know, Olu mentioned Mahukona and our exciting acquisition that will be happening probably before year's end.
So we're already working on stewardship activities and education there. We have a lease currently, and then we'll make the acquisition, and then the stewardship and education will continue after the acquisition.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Maui, where we're discovering the various environmental preserves maintained by Hawaii Land Trust, located around the Hawaiian Island, with Scott Fisher, Director of Land Stewardship, and CEO Olu Kemble. Now let's join Scott and Olu for a walkabout at Waiahe, coastal dunes and wetlands on the island of Maui.
This is the refuge here, So you drove down this road that's called Hale Bayou Road, literally Dairy Road. Hale Bayou means a dairy. Drove down this road here. We'll walk along the coast and we'll just kind of get as far as you can. This is Kalaʻiliʻili. This is that heiau called Kealakaʻihonua. 27 acres of wetlands. And so these sand dunes that you see that kind of surround us, that's what makes this area. This area was known as Kapoho, and that's what makes this area a hollow, which is what Kapoho means. And so the sand dunes that were once extensive throughout Maui's Central Valley, this is the last remaining unmodified dunes because they're, of course, in the place that's most popular for people to live. But these dunes formed about 21,000 years ago up until about 10,000 years ago. Sea level returned, and then we have it pretty much how it is today. It really informs how we manage things, right? Because, we have a wetlands on this. Everything that's standing, with the exception of the heiau, which is where we're heading right now, dates to the plantation era. When the dairy was built in 1919, none of these houses date to the earliest phase, but they all date to the pretty much the 30s and 40s.
You know the stories of these houses?
Yeah, there's a very dilapidated one, sadly. That was the physician for Wailuku Sugar. His name was Dr. Osmer. And that was his house. You can see that there's a chimney, and that chimney is interesting because it doesn't ever get cold enough to need a chimney here. Of course, we're in the tropics, but that's how he would sterilize his tools.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, his instruments. And so here we have a little plaque for some of the that we put in for the dairy workers. This was donated to us by the children of the dairy workers in memory of one of the dairy workers, 1919-1970. This you can see here is a picture of the Waiheʻi softball team. We want to recognize that, you know, this is an area where people have sentimental ties to, mainly because of their ancestral. The trail is open to the public, and people are welcome to park there. They walk along the trail, and again, it's open to the public at all times. We want them to be able to see what the refuge is, and then where the trail will be taking them, and what they'll be passing along the way. Of course, we have this photograph here of all of the life on the land. Changing hands, changing lands. This house that we're standing in front of was built in the late 1930s. It is what we call a C.W. Dickey house because that was the name of the architect. So he's a sort of a well-known Maui architect. The original function was as the manager of Wailuku Sugar's summer beach house. From what we've been told, they come down here about May and would stay until about August or September when school started. It kind of, for the last really 50 years or so, it's sat mostly unused, and so it's fallen into disrepair. We're in the process of restoring it. The restoration will turn it into a cultural education center. So we have a lot of artifacts that we have.
What's your timeline on that?
Construction, we're hoping will start sometime next year. We're in the process of fundraising for the costs, kind of a more comprehensive project that includes the removal of some other structures, like that structure over there that's kind of run down in a hazard. It includes the installation of some photovoltaics so that we can have energy power for this site, some of the other sites. And then, of course, the restoration of this into a cultural learning center. So overall, it's about a $2.8 million project. We are currently working with our partners in Washington, D.C. on a federal earmark for around $1.5 million. And that does pass through Congress. We're going to be required to raise about a $1.2 million match. And so we're in the process of raising those funds now. You know, we have thousands of students that are coming through educational programs here at Waiheʻi every year. There's not really a covered space here for them to learn when the weather is bad. So if there's any rain or anything else, their programs are canceled. So this center here will be an opportunity for education to continue when the weather is not great. It'll also be a place where visiting researchers might be able to stay for a couple of nights. It'll be a place where we can store artifacts that can then be made available for those education programs that currently have to be lugged along from another site. And then also a place where our iwikupuna, those ancestral remains, when they occasionally wash up, can be stored temporarily before they're reinterred. So it'll be a multi-purpose site.
Do you have souls that wash up on the shore?
Most of them erode out of the shoreline. We take that very seriously. It's you know, iwikupuna in Hawaiian culture are seen as being essentially sacred objects, and they have to be treated with absolute respect, so we have to address that very quickly.
Yeah, in Hawaiian thought, your mana, kind of your spiritual power, is stored in your bones. Historically, it was a very important task when somebody died to either hiding those bones or putting them someplace where, you know, people who maybe had negative interests against you couldn't get them. Right. And so sand dunes are very well known across the Hawaiian Islands for being places where burials were held. probably because they're easy places to bury people. But today, with rising sea levels and other kinds of coastal erosion, a lot of those sand dunes are being eroded, and as a result, a lot of those Iwikupuna are being unearthed. As good stewards of our, you know, our ancestral remains, you know, we make sure that we take them when we find them, we treat them responsibly, we work with people who are, you know, lineal descendants where we can, you know, to reinter those bones in an appropriate manner.
So these ahu are about, well, 2 months old and about 2 years old, and these are just places where people gather. This is where people gather to make offerings on the rite, and then to do the oli, to do the chanting.
Reasonably new.
These are very new. So we call that one the Ahuhe Palaha, and it's built around a rock that had already existed there. But it's just it's a congregation point. It's a place where you set the intention for the work you want to do.
They're modern constructions. They're built in the traditional way. Yeah, so they're all dry stacked. It's a combination of continuing practice, both in terms of what Scott's talking about, in terms of the spiritual practice, but also the very practical practice of constructing, building walls.
Humupohaku, moving that rock. It's very important cultural tradition. What we're looking at here is the focal point of our ecological restoration work over the last 20 years. Looking at the wetlands. The wetlands is 27 acres in total, and it goes basically to the base of the dunes. But we're looking into, right now, a 7-acre section of those wetlands that constitute the fish pond. So it is a type of fish pond that was known in Hawaiian as a loko'ia kalo, or literally a pond to raise fish and taro. So it was a freshwater fish pond, with water being brought from over the other side of these sand dunes into the fish pond.
It's man-made.
It's man-made fish pond, exactly. So it was the what we call the Mauka Wall, which we'll see a portion of it. We'll walk a repaired section in just a moment. Of all the people of Oceania, only the Hawaiians built fish ponds. Others had fish traps, but fish ponds. Hawaiians had 4 types of fish ponds and a fish trap, so really kind of 5. This is a loko'ia kalo. Loko'ia kalo were always freshwater because they were growing taro in them as well. And so the way it functioned was it was set back from the shoreline, fed from a stream. In this case, the stream is about between 1/2 mile and 3/4 mile away. Fish would swim into the outlet, what's known as the Awaioka Makaha. They were all marine fish. There are freshwater fish, what we call in Hawaiian o'opu. One species of the o'opu can get quite large, 5 to 7 pounds, but most of the fish that were raised in here, look, you look at these estuaries. Now, this is a spring-fed wetlands, but when you connected it to the river, it became an estuarine wetland, essentially a 27-acre estuary.
So there was saltwater intrusion then?
There was, but only limited. So what they did is, and we're only realizing now how innovative they were. So there's a channel to the left of the fish pond. That's where the salt water would preferentially go, because of course salt water is denser than fresh water. A little bit of a downflow, and that's where the fresh water would be coming out. So what it would do is it would preferentially separate the salt water from the fresh water. The salt water would only go up a certain distance, and so it was just ingenious. But the other kind of kilo aspect, the observational aspect that really made this thrive, was the fact that they had noticed that marine fish, if caught young enough, can survive in fresh water throughout their entire life cycle, and then they can be harvested. So that's a really critical thing, because all of a sudden all these nearshore marine fish become available to them, even in a freshwater system where taro is also growing. And so these incredibly productive systems. When I really talk about how do we define sustainability in Hawaii, it's restore these fish ponds. And so we are generously the beneficiary of a grant that will allow us to do that.
When will you think this will be filled with water again?
If you come here in 2 years, 2025, hopefully it will be back to a functioning fish pond.
These types of large landscape projects always take a little bit longer than we expect. But you know, I think it's important to note, this is, correct me if I'm wrong, Scott, but this is the only known example of this type of fish pond in Hawaii.
Yeah. There's one down the coast, but yes, we're absolutely in the process that is being restored. Absolutely. There's no one else doing it. This is what's really amazing about this type of system is, let's just say, hypothetically, 200 pounds of fish per acre. That's 1,400 pounds of fish. And that's probably very conservative. Then if you figure maybe 10,000 pounds of taro, 10,000 pounds of taro per acre. Typically, taro produces about 25,000 pounds in that area, 25,000 pounds per acre. But if we just kind of be conservative, you know, that's 70,000 pounds of taro and 1,400 pounds of fish. That could feed a very large population. Olu was mentioning, this is how our people thrive. This is how our ecosystems thrive. Because when the water returns, the birds will also benefit.
In taro, and the Hawaiian equivalent of the potato to the Irish.
Rice, yeah, exactly. Again, you know, for the Hawaiian people, it is your ancestor. It is haloa. So to restore taro is to also restore the culture. And so that's why it's so critical to get this moving. And as we mentioned, our colleague, Pia'i Collier, just learning so much about how to do this, that process of uhau humu pohaku. But the great thing is a community partnership. It's not just us. He has students that he's brought in, the alaka'is, and it's going to be a collaborative thing with volunteers.
That volunteers out there behind you.
Those are our archaeologists. Yeah, in part they're volunteers. I mean, our team is made up of two students from the University of Hawaii, one professor from the University of Hawaii, and two professors of archaeology from Ohio State University, and I'm the fifth wheel. So it's really exciting. What we can learn from this site is just unending. We can learn more. We can learn how to protect our coastlines. We can learn how to feed our people. We can learn how to care for our land. Having these researchers out here is so critically important. This is Scott Fisher. I am the director of Aina Stewardship, and we are at the Waiheke Coastal Dunes and Wetlands Refuge in Waiheke, Maui. For more information, you can search our website, hilt.org, or our social media platforms,
Instagram and Facebook. My name is Olu Campbell, President and CEO of Hawaii Land Trust. Thank you so much for having us on the show. Really appreciate you coming out and bringing the family with you, and hope we can stay in touch.
Yeah, really appreciate it. Really had a great time.
Cool. Me too. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from the island of Maui. We'll see you here.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, STEAM, along with studying the legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture. The Foundation at Hearst Castle not only changes the lives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors and members. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundationathearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York, and in fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.